Okay, you all ready to start with me today? I'm going to make one apology, and that is that if my voice gives out today, I'm really sorry. That means that you will just have to pick up for yourselves, okay? Psalm 40 says this, "I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, and set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure." Before I begin getting into the meat of some of the material that we're going to discuss today, I wanted to thank you all for coming to this conference today. And I say that because we are walking in the miry bog. We are choosing by some encouragement of the Lord, and some of us, the Lord having to hit over the head by 2x4s, with 2x4s, to walk in the miry bog alongside people who, like us, are saved fools. And that's who God saves, and that's who He works in. And now we're coming to situations and families that are utterly impossible, but certainly, in my experience, are common. Too common. The amount of abuse that goes on in households, even in Christian households, is huge. And all the statistics show that there is no difference between secular households and Christian households in dealing with these familial issues. And that is certainly my experience in my practice as a family lawyer, where we deal regularly with abuse situations in Christian homes, as well as in others. Before I begin, I'd like to just pray briefly. Father in heaven, I thank you for bringing these folks here today who are willing to step out and step into the mess. Father, you have not promised that our lives would not be messy, but you have called us to your Savior, and you have promised that you would redeem situations. And so, Father, give us wisdom today as we explore and discuss how you work in homes and in families and redeem them. We pray this in the power of Jesus, our Savior. Amen. Okay. What I'd like to do, I really don't want to stand up here as much and speak at you. What I'm hoping that we're going to be able to do today is engage and be a little bit interactive. And part of that is because some of the issues that you may be dealing with in your churches, or questions that may have been presented to you in your own lives or in your families, or something that you saw at your church or in your ministry, is something that we can address more specifically. In my practice, I've handled probably 1,000 abuse cases in some way or another. And by that, I mean I represent both people who are victims of abuse, children, spouses, other family members, as well as perpetrators of abuse. We're here, though, today to talk about how the church, how we as members of the church, can come alongside of people who are struggling through these kinds of issues. I wanted to talk first about what abuse is. I call it one of the A words. My A words are abuse, addiction, and adultery. So, and so the abuse issue is one that is mystified and used as one of those throw out there words all the time. In the context of a legal system, for consideration of an abuse complaint for a woman or a man to file against a spouse, there has to be actually physical abuse. So in adult situations, there has to be some level of physical abuse. That doesn't mean hitting. That means physical abuse. Physical intimidation, using physicality to intimidate in any way, constitutes abuse. Stalking is abuse. Using a body to block a doorway or to preclude movement of the other person, using your body, your physicality to do that, is abuse that is recognized under the Pennsylvania Protection from Abuse laws. There are other kinds of abuse of adults that may not be protected legally, but that are certainly issues that need to be addressed in the church. Any kind of use of power in order to intimidate can constitute abuse. Now, I'm using that word carefully because, again, I told you that I represent supposed perpetrators of abuse, too. And that word is misused by people as well. So someone says, my husband is verbally abusing me. He tells me, he gets angry at me because the dishes are not done, and he says to me, do the dishes. And I call that abuse. Well, that's not abuse in the context that I just described it to you. It is and maybe basis for an argument and maybe basis for a problem. But using any kind of physicality will be abuse. Intimidating in any way, threatening in any way, maybe something that a pastor or a church needs to look at to consider. Isolating the spouse from friends, from support systems, from other people who can fill encouraging roles to that person will also constitute abuse. And I'm saying this to you because I have heard definitions of abuse by pastors and by folks in the church that are just not sufficient or excuses for not dealing with a problem inside of a family. An abuser is going to be controlling instead of self-controlled. Now, that's another word, controlling, that people attach meaning to by their own definitions. Controlling means precluding someone from acting in a way that they would deem appropriate for themselves. Controlling means precluding conversation and disallowing conversation in areas of potential conflict. Controlling means that I am the most important person in this conversation. You, your view, your thoughts are meaningless to me. My thoughts are more important. In Christian circles, we see that kind of individual using the Bible itself to support their own thoughts, their own position, particularly in a concept, a misconstrued concept of spousal submission. Most of the time, because of the nature of it, and because of the nature of who we are and how God made us, we see the perpetrator of abuse being the male in a case. But that's not always true. I have many situations, aware of many situations, where it is mutual. There's mutual physicality in fighting, physical fighting in a family. That's what physical abuse entails. One of the most dire areas of abuse is abuse of children. And in the outline, I indicated to you that Jesus himself says that millstones will be hung about the necks of those who hurt one of the children. One of the most significant areas of this is sexual abuse of young children. Sexual abuse of young children is devastating on a huge scale, a lifetime scale. Whether that entails a parental sexual abuse, any adult infiltration of into that child's life is going to be devastating to that child. Physical abuse of children and verbal abuse of children, as well as sexual abuse, are precluded legally, but they are also devastating to the entire family in that way. One of the problems with abuse of children is assuring, understanding what is going on. The child may not be disclosing that abuse. My comment is, in getting it right, particularly talks about sexual abuse issues. If there is an allegation of sexual abuse by a child against a parent, against anyone, and the talk comes out in a way that is unusual, or the allegation comes out in a way that is unusual, unless we are certain that that child is, that the abuse is occurring, there's going to be ruining of one life or another. The life of the child is going to be ruined if we're not certain, if the alleged perpetrator is let go. The life of the perpetrator is going to be ruined if the child is not telling the truth or is prompted to be telling the truth by the other parent. Probably one of the most difficult areas to determine whether or not there is this kind of activity going on is in dealing with young children, and especially when one of the parents has himself, usually the mother, been sexually abused as a child. In a situation that I had, the mother continually tried to raise in a court system issues of sexual abuse against the other parent. The mother had been significantly sexually abused herself, and almost always that is a pattern. In that case, the issue was whether or not the mother suffered from Munchausen's disease. In other words, setting up this child to make reports and to engage in sexual activity herself in order to demonstrate some problem with the other parent. Situations like unusual sexual activity of a young child, masturbation type issues and those kinds of things, unusual discussion of sexual activity, unusual manifestation of guilt, are both evidence of abuse and evidence of prompting by a parent who would try to be protecting that child against the abuse that he or she thinks may be going on. If that is happening in the situation, if it's happening in the home, and the child is presented to the parent or to someone else as having these activities go on, one of the most difficult issues then is determining whether or not it is true. And how we determine that is not by engaging in that questioning process ourselves, but rather by incorporating the help of others, professionals who are able to make that determination. One of the issues that is striking about this is God's redemption of people who are in this situation, of children who have been sexually abused. I've seen situations where sexual abuse comes up in maturity, even where there's been long history of therapy, so that there are dreams manifests itself in dreams and in other kinds of things, even delusions, and this whole effort to disassociate from that past, that childhood. The question for, if it's the question for us in the church is this. The question is how to come up alongside of a parent or a child who comes forward making an allegation of abuse, especially of child abuse. The first issue that comes up is whether or not that allegation is true. If a parent comes to us in the church, one of the first places to seek help is through professional help, through therapeutic help. I wonder whether anyone has had any of that kind of example before, has had that kind of issue in dealing with the forthcoming of a child situation. When that's happened, what was the response of your church?
Divided. Some said, oh, it's this. Some said, oh, they made a judgment right away. And some divided in support of the child, some supported the accused.
Was the child question inside the church?
No.
Okay. And was there prosecution thereafter? Were other sources taken advantage of? God has given us other resources other than internally, especially in situations like that. God has given the legal system. God has provided us with therapists and with others who are most capable of handling that kind of situation. When there is a report of childhood abuse, the first step that needs to occur is to involve someone who is able to work with the family and ascertain the truth of that issue. If a report is made to a pastor or to a counselor in the church, there may be a responsibility of that person under a child protective services provision to make a report to the child protective services, to DHS in Philadelphia, or to the children and youth services individuals in the various counties. Counselors, doctors, those kinds of individuals are indeed mandated reporters. Pastors, counselors within the church, lay counselors within the church may not be. The goal of the church in these situations, the goal of what God has called us to do, is to come alongside. That is the key. And the problem is, how do you come alongside someone who is being abused and someone who is accused of abusing? It doesn't fit. It doesn't work. And it doesn't seem to work in any mental or rational way that we try to approach that kind of issue. It starts from the beginning, and that's why I first started to describe what to you, what is abuse, what does that mean? And when you're hearing tales, you hear tales of and sagas from women, and you see men who are shut down, rolling their eyes as to what they think may be going on in the household. You hear tales that once you get into this of life histories of people carrying into their adulthood pains of their childhood, childhoods, and now we're living in the same household, whether that is spouse on spouse or parent on child or sibling on sibling, and we're adults and we don't know how to deal with this anymore. Worse is the situation, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, involving children. Children who have no concept of what it is to be safe and loved. And destroyed, of course, in this whole process is the concept of father and the concept then of God. And so where else but would Satan invade than in the home? That's his primary place of invasion besides our own minds. Because once the home is disrupted and destroyed, father is disrupted and destroyed, and therefore God concepts are disrupted and destroyed. The church shies, it appears to me, shies away from these issues. And I say that especially in the Reformed churches that most of us are involved in. I'm very thankful for a lot of changes that are going on at 10th Presbyterian Church, where I worship, in this way, where there's a lot of growth going on in understanding these issues. There are steps that need to be taken when a report of abuse is made. The first step that needs to be understood is that for the abuser to come forward and seek help is an overwhelming, huge issue. Whether that is a child, a teenager, or someone who suffered from childhood abuse many years ago, whether it is a spouse, whether it is someone who is elderly, it is overwhelmingly difficult to come forward and to seek help. The church cannot shut that seeking down. When help is sought, it is not, the first step is not investigation as to whether or not what that abused, I'm going to call that person a victim because that's what you're used to hearing. The first step is not to determine whether or not the victim is telling the truth. The first step is to provide sanctuary to that victim. Perceived truth on the victim's part is enough for the church to take the position of providing sanctuary, provide a safe place. And that can take various roles. If you were in Eileen's group a little bit earlier, you know that there are places, there are houses, there are safe places that people can be placed. At 10th, I know that often an apartment is rented for a period of time, depending on the church that is involved, how much money is involved. Some safe place needs to be set up for this victim and the children of the victim. If the victim is a child, other steps need to be taken to make sure that that child is protected. Legally, there are steps that can be taken to make sure that that child is protected. I'm getting to you. So the question then becomes, is there a responsibility if a child comes forward to call and report that child to the Child Protective Services agency in that community, whether it's DHS or whether it's CYS or whatever it is. If the report is made to a church member, a regular lay church member, that person is not a mandated reporter, and it may be appropriate to do some other homework first in the context of that sanctuary, in the context of that protection. You asked me a little bit ago whether someone who may be a mandated reporter, like a teacher in a school system who has a different role, like maybe a Sunday school teacher in school, does that mandated reporter piece carry over to that Sunday school teacher? My gut reaction is take the safe way, and if you're a mandated reporter, you're a mandated reporter regardless of where you are. The reason why it's important to report if you are a mandated reporter is you can be charged with, now a summary offense, used to be a misdemeanor, if you do not report. Harder are lay people in the church in roles of leadership. Those individuals are not protected. They are not mandatory reporters, but they're in a legal sense, but there may be issue in that regard there. First step in coming alongside, provide sanctuary. Second step, call in the alleged perpetrator. Now it's time to find out, I'm going to say his because it's usually his, and I say that because men generally will manifest their issues in anger and women in fear and shame. And so it doesn't mean that the fear and shame are better than the anger, it's just that that's how it is. So now the man is called in to begin this investigation. Now, the sanctuary the woman has now is she's in a safe place. And she may also be encouraged to, if the situation warrants it, if there is any kind of physicality, to file a protection from abuse complaint. My view as an attorney in dealing with protection from abuse issues is this. You file and then pull back. There are some, you can pull that thing back if you need to. You file that and you get the protection for the person. And then if you need to provide other provisions later and limit it later, you can. Another vehicle that I use in efforts to provide protection for a person is to take it out of the abuse system and put it into another system and still get a child custody system and still provide protection without having the hammer of the threat of police coming to the door if there is contempt of that protection from abuse order. That's a whole lot of information in a short version. The gist of it is, don't think that allowing that person to go live in a safe house for a couple of weeks is going to fix the problem. It won't. The anger is not going to stop. Now, let's talk about the perpetrator. Perpetrator comes in, crying. Big guy comes in crying, and he says, "All I want is my marriage back. I shouldn't have done it. I didn't hit her. I didn't really hit her. I didn't do anything like that. All I did was just give her a dirty look." Now, of course, he may have given her a dirty look a half an inch from her face so that she's up against the wall, but that's what he thinks. And he really thinks that. All I did was give her a dirty look in his controlling mindset. I want my marriage back. Get my marriage back. Now, the coming alongside in the church looks like this. I have one spouse over here crying that the marriage should be broken up. This man's an ogre. He does all these horrible things. He's mean and nasty. He's physical with me. I'm scared to death of him. This has been going on for X number of months or years. Perpetrator comes in and he says, "Wait a minute, I've never heard any of that before. She hasn't said anything like that to me before. That is not what is going on. Of course we had our arguments from time to time, but that's all that has ever happened." She still needs sanctuary. She's crying abuse. I'm telling you, she needs sanctuary. He needs to be understood in the sense of two things. One is, he might be telling the truth. And two is, the first excuse that a perpetrator will use, the first effort that a perpetrator will make, is to get the thing back to where it was, because that's when he felt in control. And that's why it's so hard. That's why I say you can't be wrong. And the way not to be wrong is to keep protecting and keep talking. So you're coming alongside over here. Over here, you say to this man, "If I agree with you and tell her that she can't be protected, that means that everything that you say is true, and I don't know who's telling the truth. I really don't. So therefore, I'm going to tell you that you need at this point to have some provision of accountability, and we're going to hold you accountable, and you're going to be in with a counselor, and I'm going to see what that counseling piece is going to be, what that's going to look like." He says, "No, church says, then we're going to tell her she can file her protection from abuse complaint and she's still going to be safe. We are not going to tell her to come back to you until you meet these requirements." Whether or not she's telling the truth, whether or not everything that she says is true. And as an attorney, I will tell you that when I have a client come in, I do not believe that everything that they are telling me is the truth. Many times they will enhance their position, and even when they think they're telling me everything, even when they think they're telling me everything so much so that they objectify it to the other side, it is only their perspective of the truth. It's only their perception of what they think is going on, and it's not the true truth that they are presenting. Certainly, if they come to the church, you're not going to hear true truth. You're going to hear church truth. You're going to hear it slanted. You're going to hear it favored a little bit. Simultaneously is providing counseling and accountability to the alleged perpetrator. That is the only hope for him. And requiring him to see where he is wrong and to admit to the church wrongfulness, provide counseling to the wife and to kids if they are involved. Use those counselors, use those lawyers. They are church tools. They are God's tools. They are created by God, gifted by God to do those tasks. They are not just somebody else outside. Use them to draw and to ascertain whether or not these people can come back together. A catch that churches fall into is valuing the marriage or valuing the even a relationship over and above any other issue that is going on inside the family. So the church will say, husband wants marriage back. He's got to be right. He is right. That's words we like to use. That is righteous. God hates divorce, and so he must be right. In taking that kind of position, the church is saying that any other sin is better than the sin of divorce. The church is saying unequivocally, unilaterally, divorce is always a sin. The act of divorce itself is always a sin, and that is a sin worse than any other. The mess, the muck and mire, and why I looked at Psalm 40 is, that's the position that we're in. That's the position as we come alongside these folks that we walk in. We have to make and work with them to decide between sins. It's not fun. It's horrible. It feels horrible. And we feel horrible doing it. It is overwhelmingly that way. And when you do it, when you see it unfold, when you see it continuously, it will eat you up as well. Now, it gets worse. This is where it gets worse. Remember I told you that there are certain folks here who may be mandated reporters in the child situation? Well, if you're walking alongside these in the abuse family in the way that I'm describing here, you're holding yourself out to be a witness in a case. You're holding yourself out for perhaps liability in some way if it's not handled correctly, maybe invasion of privacy and defamation type issues. You're not protected in the sense of having privilege like a pastor would be or an attorney would be or a counselor, not even a counselor, a psychologist would be. You are holding yourself out in a very raw way. And to the extent that, as I said, you might be a witness, you might get sued. In my line of work, I don't know if June has had that experience yet, but I've had my life threatened, and not once, a number of times. And it comes, the problem is we're in the muck. It comes with the territory. I had this conversation with Ed Welsh one time, and I think we concluded that if you're not sued or you're not threatened, at least every once in a while, you might not be doing your job. And that is true for pastors, and that is true for we lay folks in the church, elders in the church, who are sticking their necks outside, not getting paid in time, spending all these hours doing this work. Now, here's the joy of it. The joy of it is, and this is the biggest joy, I think, of my job. You see God's redemption. You see it. It unfolds, and that walking alongside, it unfolds right in front of you. God lifts out of the muck and mire and sets your feet on a rock. He takes that woman who is being abused, it's as though he picks her right up. You know how dads pick up their kids right at the elbows? He picks her right up, throws it in. In my younger days, I used to do a lot of whitewater rafting with my son. And I remember going on this one trip where, of course, when you do these heavy duty. So we went up to Canada. We were nuts. And we do these high volume rapids. You know, they were crazy. And you had to have a guide with you on the boat. So we'd be there in our wetsuits and our helmets and all these rapids, like a wet water roller coaster. Well, of course, as soon as you're in the middle of something horrendously luminous, they tip the boat on purpose. They do it on purpose. And certainly our guide, who was this little 115-pound girl, tipped this boat full of me and teenagers, most boys, many of whom were 200 pounds. Well, after she enjoyed flipping us all over into this swirly, voluminous rapid, these rapids were at least 6 to 8 feet high. She grabbed us. She would just come by. She got a hold of that boat, and she grabbed all 8 of the participants in this boat. The little thing, I mean, you see how big I am, right under the arms, right back on that boat. That, to me, is a picture of redemption. I never had that experience before. Right back on that boat. That's what God does. And when you are walking alongside of these people in this situation, that is what you see. God will turn hearts. God will turn souls. Now, here's the big problem. Sometimes he doesn't do it in our time. He does it in his time. I told you that I've worked in this area for many years. I also have a personal history. And I will tell you that for 29 years now, I have been praying for my ex-husband's salvation. And there is no doubt in my mind that that man is saved. He just does not know it yet. And I tell him that straight to his face. And I'm sure of that. I'm sure that that is true. I'm sure that that is what God will do. And that's not very Presbyterian, but Phil Reichen says I'm allowed to say it. I told you that I would do the little version of my presentation. That's about it that I can do right now. But I want to take some of your questions and pick up some of this if we can. Okay. I know you're looking at me like... Should I tell stories? I can tell a story. Do you have this experience in your churches? I know you do, because I get calls from your pastors. I know, if you are a pastor, and maybe have not received a call from you. But this is the piece. And what the church wants to do is, kind of take the middle road. What we want to kind of balance this out, and have a sense of, well, somehow this family is going to come back together, and we can fix it. Well, guess what? You're not going to. That's an issue. To me, that's an issue of both pride on the part of the pastor. Or the individual who thinks that he's going to be able to fix this situation. You cannot. These are the kinds of situations that are fixed only by prayer and fasting, and by a lot of intervention. This type of abuse is addictive abuse. It is it is ongoing and is personality disorder deep. And so the only way to change that is with God's intervention, much grace, and with heavy-duty therapy in which the people seek that help. The hardest issue with children, the hardest issue with wives who finally come forward and say, yes, I want to do this, is that before they undertake finalizing that process, they will turn around and deny it. They'll turn around and go back, where the child will say, I don't, that did not happen to me. And the reason is that there's a much greater comfort in knowing what the pain will be than in guessing what it will be if it has to change. And women who are controlled in that way, children who are controlled in that way, bear that kind of dichotomy, that risk. In the outline, I indicated to you the kinds of underlying motivators, the root issues of abuse. For the perpetrator, anger's at the top. For the victim, anger's at the bottom, but it's still present. I will share with you one experience that I myself had. A couple of years after I was divorced, I started to get angry at something. And I was so proud of myself. I had been an attorney in a big law firm at that time, and I was so proud of myself because I thought that I was very controlled and that I had my anger issues and any temper issues all under control. I realized that what I really was numb. And what you see in situations of abuse is individuals who, abused person, the victim, becomes numb to any feeling because it's easier and safer to be numb than to be angry or to be passionate or to be loving. It's safer to be numb because then you don't have to deal with the rest of the issues. I was struck to find that very factor in my own life. Another phenomenon that occurs in abuse situations that you will see over and over again and will trigger in your mind, once you start seeing it, you'll know that this is an abusive household. And the trigger is this, it works like this. Spouse is abused, whatever level of abuse that we talk about. Perpetrator is angry, is the abuser, the spouse is the victim. Spouse goes off and is hurt. Perpetrator realizes at some point later that he in some way caused that harm and then comes crawling back. I'm so sorry. I never will do it again. That same motivation that causes that perpetrator to come to his pastor and say, I'm the one who wants to restore this marriage. I'm the one who wants to be here, is the motivation that says, I will never do this to you again. Perpetrator now becomes rescuer, and victim now is rescued by perpetrator. But the spiral continues. As soon as that settles in, the victim now becomes a victim again. There's one other piece, I missed one. The perpetrator now in becoming the rescuer says, I'm so sorry. Now the perpetrator looks like a victim too. Do you see that switch? He made himself a victim. And the victim now comes back and says, I believe you. Don't cry. Here, I'm crying too. Let me help you. Yes, it was my fault. It was all my fault. I shouldn't have looked at you funny when you threw that pan at me. The issue is, let me rescue you. So now we have the victim becoming the rescuer. And that settles in until the next time. And you go through the whole spiral again, this role-changing piece. And as you seek to understand the events that are explained to you, you will know those things to be true. In coming alongside of that victim, you know, I said to you that the first thing that we do is provide sanctuary. In getting to the truth, though, of whether that victim now is telling the truth, ask the next question, because the victim it is enough for her to come forward to say, this is what's happening in my household. She may describe one incident. But if you ask the next question, did he ever come this close to you? Did he ever come at you with hands, clenched fists, even though they were down? Did you ever fear that he was going to hit you? What were the circumstances that caused that kind of fear? Now, I mean, I've had situations where, yeah, I thought he was going to hit me. He was across the room and he was making a funny face at me. That tells you one thing. He was in my face with his fists clenched, barking at me as loud as he could so that my ears were clogged. And I thought that at any minute, if I moved the wrong way, he was going to strike me with one of his clenched fists. That's the difference. And in a legal proceeding, you'll need more than one incident of that, at least two. The other piece with the legal aspect of this is that it needs to be handled if a protection from abuse is going to be filed. It needs to be filed promptly. Not immediately, but promptly, usually within 30 days. I like to see it filed within 10 days of the last event. And that's because on the legal side of it, you have to show and prove fear. I said to Betsy earlier today that in representing cases involving abuse, I probably have a higher success rate. I think my rate is pretty good, but I think I probably have a higher success rate in representing defendants because this is tossed around frequently. On the other hand, the reason for that is that when the event is demonstrated, the case always settles. So that, you know, if there's demonstrated abuse, the case is going to settle. And the reason why is the defendant then does not have to make an admission of guilt. It'll settle.
What do you do if you sense abuse, child abuse, like if you come alongside a kid and you go, hey, how are you, and there's the flinch, or they're just subtle kinds of things that are red flags, but there's no admission, no, how would you deal with that kind of thing, probing?
I think that's a good question, and I think that if I knew a child in that situation, I would invite that child to talk to me. If you have anything that you have concerns about, you can always talk to me. A safer person for that child to talk to is school guidance counselor. They're always safe. They are mandated reporters. School is always going to follow up on it. There's not going to be a connection if the child needs to be excluded from the parent, you know, that kind of thing. It's not a perfect system, but that it's effective.
Marianne, what about, you mentioned that regular church people are not mandated reporters. When do you recommend they do report it, though?
I guess that the issue is, it depends. In the church, I think that it's appropriate if there is, let's say a child comes in with a mark and says, my dad beat me last night with a strap. I think that in the church it is appropriate to call in the parents in that situation. I'm not sure that a pastor is not a mandated reporter, though. A pastor could be a mandated reporter. And the issue is whether or not the pastor is, in his normal line of work, counseling children. So if he's normally a counselor, pastor counselor, he may fit in that definition.
I think one of the things that happened sort of in my world at the time was that when a family was alerted to the fact that people were catching on to the abuse, their three-year-old drowned that weekend in the bathtub. So I think that we have to be very, very cautious.
Yep.
With how we approach calling in people or bringing our suspicions or cautions to them. I caused a child, when I was a very young teacher, to get a pretty severe beating because I told him he'd pushed my last button as his teacher, and I told him I was going to call his mother. He went home, told his mom I was going to call, and I went home and took a nap and didn't call, and his mother beat him for lying. So I've learned some pretty harsh lessons.
Yeah, but see, that issue, that the
so
piece of that...
So we have to be careful, is all I'm saying. As yeah. adults that are coming around these types of really dangerous situations.
Yeah, but here's, but the other side of that is that that when that occurred, that was not your fault. That was the mother's, that was still the issue within the mother's household. And it's not we who are going to be who are going to be causes of that. And again, I mean, I think as Reformed believers, it's the peace comes that God is sovereign over those issues. And but you're right. The question is, how do we approach that? And that's why I say, for instance, child reporting sexual abuse, for instance, should not be questioned. That needs to be done by the experts, because if that sexual abuse is going on, there is a lot of law on preclusion of testimony by that child or by an expert, because that child's testimony is tainted. There may be criminal activity that is going on, and that child was going to be viewed as being tainted. Anything else?
On the other hand, you have people who learn to use that, use the accusation of sexual molestation as a ploy, saying, all I have to say is you sexually molested me, and I don't have to prove it.
Well, that's not true. As I said, the cases are difficult, especially of young children who are not able to really understand those issues yet. When you deal with that with teenagers, you have a little bit of a different situation, but there's still a need for evidence of that kind of activity. And the word of the teenager, frankly, teenagers are fairly easy to cross-examine. I don't believe in cross-examination of in personal relationships, but there were a couple of times when my son was a teenager that was an appropriate technique. And don't be intimidated as a parent or as a church leader by that kind of a threat. With children, on the other hand, there are, there are actions and behaviors that are demonstrative of sexual activity. So an overly sexualized child, a child who engages in sexual activity that he or she would not otherwise know about, or reports about sexual activity that is way beyond his or her possibility of understanding or knowing. that the kind of behaviors that you described before, the kind of pulling away, physical issues. I think most pointedly in that kind of situation, I did have a situation a few years ago where the child was engaging, a four-year-old, in those kinds of behaviors. And it took two psychiatrists to take a look at this thing, because the issue was a custody issue between these two parents. And my client was the mother who kept filing, before she hired me, started filing all kinds of paperwork, all kinds of PFAs, protection from abuse complaints, all kinds of reports to CYS. My daughter is being sexually abused by her father. And take the kid down to CHOP every 5 minutes, that whole thing. So she has this history of this activity. And the psychological issue was whether the problem was with the mother. And that mother almost lost custody, but she had a good lawyer. that is the problem. That is the issue. How do you determine that kind of evidence? So even though the child was manifesting this, the mother was prompting it. Now, to this day, I cannot be sure, as I sit here and talk to you, that father was not molesting that child. I am not positive. And that is a problem. That is the problem. I am not sure that the mother was not molesting that child. I don't know. And that is the issue that I think is always in front of us. The issue then is to come alongside. And why was that going on? The mother was molested as a child. That's the source of all that. No one is going to touch this baby except her. And so when those issues come up, if I hear sexual abuse being tossed out in kind of a vacuum, the first thought that comes to my mind is that the person who was tossing it out had some issue of sexual abuse in childhood. And I'm almost always right in that way. It's not because I'm right, it's because that's what prompts it.
Yeah, I just wanted to say there's some great resources like related to domestic abuse that are, or one book that I found that does like a real, like Leslie Burnett, are you familiar with her?
Sure.
She just released a book called The Emotionally Destructive Relationship, and I think she addresses specifically, like you mentioned a while ago, like I think as churches we do have to be careful not to say, well, wives are supposed to be submissive, you know, and in that way, like, I think she really addresses the danger of just even of some of that thinking, like, we can mess abuse that's happening right in front of our eyes. So,
right.
Yeah, so I found her to be a really good resource.
She is good. I know her, actually, and she's a very good counselor. And insightful in a way, as is Diane and the counselors in her practice. In that way.
What's the name of the author?
Leslie Vernick, Vernick.
And she has her website too.
Yeah, she's written a couple of things. Exactly is the issue, but I think that we need to that sense of coming alongside is the key. Anything else?
Can you talk a little bit about elder abuse, like of an adult child abusing their parents, even if it's verbal?
Yeah, that's tough.
Kind of intimidation.
That's tough because it may not be illegal. It's an issue that the church needs to step in on. I had a situation recently where I was talking with Phil Reichen, and I said, you know, legally I can't do anything about this situation, Phil. And his answer to me was, but the church can. And that is true. That is the greatest tool that God has made. So that the issue with adults is always physical abuse. There has to be some kind of physicality involved in elder abuse or in spousal abuse. It is any relationship within the family. But the if there is threat of physical abuse, that can also constitute. So if you don't do this, you're not going to have dinner for the next, you won't feed you for the next week. May constitute a basis for protection from abuse action, that kind of thing. But you're talking about, that kind of, a little bit of growling, that kind of thing. I wish you would just do this, and that kind of thing going on all the time. It's not going to be. So I'm not sure what the specific examples are. I'd have to hear that. But it has to be kind of a threat to be involving a legal issue. The other problem, the issue that you raise, is there is a statute in Pennsylvania, which is a problem, I think, perhaps for all of us, that family members do have a responsibility to provide care for indigent family members, for close indigent family members, so that you may have an elderly person who is kind of dumped on somebody else. And it comes up a lot in nursing homes who are trying to seek payment of their bills from other family members. So that of course, creating that animosity that may be present in that kind of situation. Do you have a specific?
I do, but yeah.
Yeah. You can talk to me about that later if you need to. Well, thank you all for coming today. I apologize that I'm not on my game today. I'm not. So if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them in a little bit. If I could just close in prayer, I'd appreciate that. Father in heaven, you are good and kind to us, and I thank you for allowing me to come back down and restore some of this conversation today. I pray, Father, that you would give us strength and direction and wisdom as we walk through the muck of the alongside the lives of those who you bring to us. Father, I pray that you will give grace to the hearts of all of these folks who are here today. Comfort them, encourage them, take away their fear, give them your strength. And Lord, I just pray this in the name and the power of Jesus Christ, our Savior. Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you all. I apologize. Thanks.